in Japan. He's a former executive director of the Stockholm Environment Institute in Sweden. And Dr. Kasperson received his PhD from the University of Chicago. Please join me in welcoming him.
Thank you. Like everyone else here, I want to share my great appreciation of being invited to be part of this process of honoring Frank. And it does give us all an opportunity to tell at least one story, right? So I have a different story than I think everybody here, and Frank's probably already anticipating what it is. What about more than 20 years ago or something like that? Frank and I had a joint project done for Swedish sponsors in which we had the difficult task of running around Europe interviewing people in government, NGOs, industry, and so forth so that we could try to write a report on what the current status of radioactive, high-level radioactive waste management was. So that was the official agenda. And we did write a report on that subject, actually. The unofficial agenda is that we were also conducting our own survey of the culinary positive and negative assets of various countries that we were going around. We never, which included also sampling some of the better wines that were available. We never wrote a report on this subject, but I think we did hone our skills and got quite good at cooperating in our efforts to do that. And of course, when you travel around, you have that kind of experience with another person over weeks of time and so forth. You really get to know people well. So I developed a lifelong respect and friendship for Frank that we've also played out in some other arenas and so forth. But anyhow, it was a lovely experience. I recommend it to anybody else. I'd like to make, before I start my formal talk, I'd like to make an observation about the last 2 days. A number of us here, I think, are people who have been around this issue for quite a long time. I think my first meeting on radioactive waste management began in Chicago in 1975, as I recall. And I've had some continuing involvement since then. There are even longer histories of people here going back to Lyons and things like that. Many of us are fond of saying that, if you work in this arena and you're out of it for 5 or 10 years and you come back to a meeting, it's like you never left. You have a little catching up to do of information and so forth. But let me make an observation that's a little bit different than that. I don't think that even 10 years ago that what has happened at this meeting over the last 2 days could have happened. I see a major difference in the kinds of talks that are being given, the kinds of issues we're focusing and concentrating on. And as I've thought about it over the last 2 days, I think a real good news part of taking this experience as a whole, the good news part is I think we're doing something like the process of creating a new kind of environmental assessment that begins with the sort of social technical system that many people have talked about, that we're viewing the system that we're interested in as a coupled system in which the social issues and the technical issues are highly intermingled and mixed. And we're trying to figure out an integrated analysis of how you how you do the analysis and you deal with the relevant findings and problems that are uncovered. And I think that's very encouraging. I've been getting drawn in a lot lately into the climate change arena, where I think that's not beginning yet, that whole process. And I think it's a long history that we've had in this area, and the fact that those of us in the social sciences, of course, have not been able to escape learning something about the technical issues. But I think all you technical people have learned a lot about the kinds of things that Mike and I and others are interested in. And it's not superficial knowledge. I think, you're all getting a lot of depth into the social technical system. And I think it's very encouraging. And at some point, we need to sit back and say, how do we replicate this in some other areas I'm working on? I don't see this happening at all. And this is a mature area that has been rent with conflict and the intermingling of technical and social issues. So that's an opportunity. That's the good news. I think there is a bad news side that Mike has laid out very, very well for us, is that also, as I listen to the talks over the last 2 days, I've thought, well, you know, it's really great that people are, in all the presentations that are being made, are talking about our ability to learn by my subject today, engaging publics and engaging social issues and engaging decision makers. And we're handling the problem in a different way than we used to. That does not mean that we're where we need to be. Because, as Mike has pointed out very well, there actually are major gaps in our knowledge. You can't get there just by talking with people and talking with decision makers. We need the kind of depth of technical that you have in the technical issues, and we don't have it yet in the social science area. Actually, this area has been more worked over by social scientists than some other arenas. I happen to be getting interested in wind energy and trying to look at that, and I can tell you that we haven't even scratched the surface of the social issues in that particular area. We know next to nothing about many of the issues that we've been talking about here are replicated in the wind area, and we know nothing about them. Or to take another example, I didn't get to intervene yesterday when we were talking about transportation risk. I'm delighted to hear that we're dealing with social issues and people are talking about that. But I know really of no, I don't know, Mike, if you do, in-depth studies of the social issues connected with the transportation system. Maybe Kevin Crowley, if he's still here, could enlighten me about that. But I think there are many areas where the knowledge base dealing with the kinds of issues you now are all engaging is superficial or non-existent, and they need to be filled. And we need to think of these social issues as researchable, empirical kinds of problems that we need to try to understand. We need to research. We need to work on them in the same way that we try to understand, you know, the technical system. And by and large, that hasn't happened. Some of the studies that Mike has done, and also work that Paul Slovak and others, Carwood Kornreuther, have done, much of which were funded by the state of Nevada, but actually originally that was DOE money. But that program has ended, and we haven't had anything like the equivalent of that continuing. So there's good news and bad news in terms of, I think, what's happening. In the climate change area, we can get people to understand that they need to talk to decision makers and others about it. I think the people in the federal government who are working on the programs don't yet really appreciate that we need to do serious basic research on the social and economic issues connected with climate change, because our understanding is as superficial in that area as you can imagine. And it's going to actually take a substantial effort for us to catch up and begin to create the kind of knowledge base that we actually need to make risk-informed or any other kind of informed decisions. Okay, I've already taken too much time, so I'll try to do this. I'll try to do this quickly. First slide, please. What I'm going to do, and I'll try to do it quickly, is to talk about the, say something about the fact that I think in the way that we're reshaping the processes of how we're trying to make decisions and manage radioactive waste, there's a major underlying strategic choice, which was very apparent in the Swedish presentation, by the way, between the extent to which, you know, we have a continuum in terms of kind of institutions and processes we use between those that are really focused on consent as a strategy to those that really rely upon coercion. And I think there are very heavy implications of where you are on that continuum. It was very clear in Tom Isaac's presentation of the Canadian situation of a major shift on that continuum from coercion to consent. But there are also lots of issues connected with how far you're going to move in that direction. And I'll say something about the roots of public concern about the waste question. Mike has already done that in part. I do want to say something about the history that we have in this area, that particularly the talks yesterday outlined the history of our process here and some of the things that have gone right and wrong. And that's a legacy that we have to deal with. That doesn't go away. And I think there's sometimes an understanding, a perception that, well, that's behind us now. So now we can au nouveau, you know, try to deal with some of the issues. Well, people have long memories. And that legacy is sitting there, and it has a bill connected with it. And we have to pay that bill in the process. And so I want to say something about that. Social trust has already been talked about. I'll say a little bit more about that. I want to briefly note that we found out yesterday, if you didn't know it already, that in 1975, Nevada was very open and indeed interested in being considered as a site for a nuclear waste repository. We did a study during the 1980s of what happened to that initial interest that was there in Nevada, and how did it turn into major opposition. I'd like to say a few words about that because I think it's instructive. Now, I think we all think that looking ahead to a new generation of whether it's, you know, the future, the next 10 or 15 years with Yucca Mountain, or whether we have a new, you know, resurgence of the nuclear option in the United States, that this is occurring in a changed environment. And two of the things that are interesting about that are climate change and energy security and how they sort of interact with public opinion. And I'd like to say a few words about that, although I feel very, Mike would tell us right at the beginning that those are interesting areas, but have been very little examined in any of this. I think we all have some intuitions about it, but I think, in fact, we don't know how those two things are reverberating back on public attitudes to nuclear waste and to nuclear energy. I want to suggest that however those attitudes are changing, there were some cautions connected with, even if there's a more positive attitude developing out there in the United States, I want to give you something from the wind energy area to make you cautious and not feel overly optimistic on that basis. And then I'll end up saying something quickly about, well, some of the major things that I think the ingredients that ought to be in a new generation of public engagement efforts in this area. Okay, next slide, please. So I think there is a strategic choice that all the countries basically that have been dealing with nuclear waste have been confronting, which is, where are we going to position the next set of institutional efforts and processes connected with managing nuclear waste on the consent coercion continuum? And as you know, I mean, we inherited originally in this area a particular kind of culture that came primarily out of the military and out of the weapons area. It was one that emphasized secrecy and technical primacy, talking now about the United States. And I would describe that as a program heavily based upon assumptions and notions of coercion and preemption as and the supremacy of technical thinking as a way to move ahead in making these kinds of choices. And but I want to make the argument in my talk that the context of public attention and concern are very much affected by the kind of strategic choice that's being made in the way that institutions are operating and decision-making processes are moving forward in terms of how they engage the coercion and the consent kinds of trade-offs. And we found in the Swedish case, to take the Swedish case and the Canadian case, which we had presented, the Swedish case has probably gone as far, and maybe Klaus can correct me if I'm wrong, in the direction of achieving a very high level of consent, both at the national level, but also at the level, at the particular site level. And that's different than what's happening in Canada, which is openness and willingness to consider being a site, but not necessarily to actually have a veto right over the location of the repository there. So we have a lot of movement, I think, moving in the direction of consent and siting. And I think that has a major interrelationship with the nature of public concerns and public attention. Tom Isaacs was making the argument yesterday that, you know, in the end, you really have to find out what people are concerned about, and rather than try to convince them that what they're concerned about is not right, it's the wrong thing to do, try to resolve those concerns, try to be responsive to them, and so forth. Well, that's, I would describe that as an approach putting a high premium on developing, you know, a large amount of consent in the system. And I'm going to end up arguing that is the way to go, I think, very clearly in this area, because I think the public concerns are not going to disappear in this realm. I'll make that argument when we get to the climate change. And so I think the major challenge that we'll be facing in the next generation, because I do think this context that we were talking about yesterday in society, there is a change in context in which these processes are occurring. So it's not very relevant to talk about, you know, the fact that people accepted the Nevada test site and so forth. Forget it. That's history. And if we were trying to locate the Nevada test site au nouveau now, you'd see a very different situation, I'm confident, in that case. So the context in which society is viewing these things, some people have described it as, you know, we used to have in the United States a very strong assumption that technological development, some new technology, some new industrial facility, this was something to be valued and welcomed, to be given premium. It's not that way anymore. Many people have argued that there's been a cultural shift against technology, and people are now hypercritical of technology. So there's some new technological innovation or new technological program or facility or so forth, and so your ability to be able to get there through coercion, if you will, or preemption, rather than achieving a high degree, consent is more and more limited. Just one other thing about the coercion. I think it's a seductive pathway that I think once you start on a pathway in either one of these directions, you get pushed farther and farther in the direction. So one of the implications of employing coercion strategies in nuclear waste management or other areas of technology management is that you get pushed more and more in the direction. You have to use more and more coercion develops. You have the development of public opposition and people's unhappiness as you use strategies of conversion. You end up having to use more and more and more and more in order to get where you're going. And I think you get a similar kind of pathway that develops in the consent area. So once you get on these pathways, there's a built-in momentum in it. And so I think that strategic choice and really thinking out how far you're going to go down the pathway in either of these directions in the way that you design processes and institutions are really critical kinds of decisions. Next one, please. Very quickly, Mike would tell us, and he'd be right, that these are many areas that we know something about in the public opinion, public attitude area. But most of these things we don't understand nearly as well as we should. But some of the things that we know are important is that the public is very concerned about the fact that nuclear energy was born in weapons of destruction. We've written some things in the past in which we describe, you know, some of the problems connected with nuclear waste and attitudes to other areas of the nuclear fuel cycle is the fact that it's been sort of like a Hydra thing and very frustrating for people in nuclear energy. You put reactor risks relatively to bed in terms of public concerns and immediately waste is back on the agenda, or the attention and criticism shifts to another area of the nuclear fuel cycle. And it's made us wonder in previous writings whether there is a sort of war going on, at least with a segment of the public, which is really with the nuclear fuel cycle, not with the components of the thing. So that's a problem for nuclear waste as well as other areas. We know that generally in the risk area that hazards that are rare but have a catastrophic potential particularly problematic areas for the public. We do have these past accidents that have occurred that have sort of underlined that problem. We've talked only a little bit about, and not in depth, about inequities. We've noted that these ethical issues, and Bob's talk was certainly highlighting some of these for us, as was Tom Isaacs in talking about, you know, it's the right thing to do and so forth. Well, there are these difficult problems of intra and intergenerational issues that run through that complicate the risk problems for the public in dealing with this area. And those inequities need to be dealt with, that fairness becomes a major issue in public concerns about this. And this has also been going back again to the coercion theme, that at least in the early history, and things are changing, we've had relatively closed policy and regulatory management system around radioactive waste, which have not entirely changed in the last 10 or 20 years of experience at Yucca Mountain. Next, please. Just a word about this legacy that, as you know, Alvin Weinberg was famous for saying that the problem in the nuclear fuel cycle that he most underestimated was the waste problem. A number of the Academy reports that have come out have sort of confirmed that one of the major problems we've had that I think we're getting past now, finally, but the legacy is there, is that we've underestimated how difficult this problem was, and we've not put in place the kinds of resources and processes and so forth to get the job done. We're now doing it, But sorry, but people remember the fact that it didn't get done, that we've had a start and stop process in this, that we've had a number of failures and errors that have occurred in this system. And we may think we're beyond it now, but it's become part of the context with which the public evaluates and responds to the waste problem. So that's a legacy. I describe that as a legacy problem. Don't think the legacy issues have gone away. They're there. And they're part of the context in which social evaluation of the nuclear waste problem occurs. And we have to confront it as part of what we're doing. It's one of the outcomes of that has been a very high level of social distrust. So the distrust, in a way, I want you to understand, is not irrational. That the distrust is a measure of what has happened in the history of how we've managed radioactive waste in the United States. And I thought, in that interesting exchange between Bob Budnicks and Tom Cochran yesterday, which I thought, oh, that's interesting, but sorry, it's really irrelevant because the people going to make decisions on this and who are going to bear the risk are not Tom Cochran, and they're not going to be able to figure out where they come out on the question of, they have to decide whether they're going to trust people or not. Now, if you have the legacy of the history we have in this area, would it be rational on the part of anybody in the state of Nevada to trust the process? No. I mean, so that's a starting point for me in thinking about then, what is a management system that really takes account of legacy problems? And so you'll hear me, I'll jump to my conclusion about this, that don't think you're going to win trust, people, because it's not going to happen in this area. It's not going to happen in the time frame, at least, that you need it to happen to get timely decisions and to move the process along. So my message to this is going to be work to deserve the trust on the part of the public, but assume you're not going to get it, and design processes that take account of the fact that you're going to be dealing with an environment of high social distrust, and we need to get the job done as a society and as a nation, and you need to do it then in the face of continuing high levels of distrust. And those continuing high levels of distrust are not irrational, they're rational. That's where someone should be in looking at the kind of process. That's where I would be if I were sitting there. I would say, I can't work through all the all these issues and come up with Tom Cochran's answer. So I've got to decide, do I trust the people who are running this program to do the job, to make this a safe repository and so forth? These are the people that have changed the siting process, that put political decision ahead of science, that changed the regulatory standards and so forth. I should trust a process that operates in that particular way? Okay. So that's a problem for us to think about as a next generation problem in this area. I don't need to talk more about that. Why don't I go on? Okay, maybe I've said what I need to do. I do want to say, as Mike has already said, that it would be nice to have a long talk and discussion here about social trust, and I'd be very interested in doing that. And we're not going to have, we've all raised it as a major issue, but it deserves some detailed conversation and in-depth conversation. So Mike has pointed out, and I'll just add a little bit to what he said, that partly to indicate how difficult I think it is, I should actually say two things. One is that social trust is multidimensional, as Mike indicated. And so competence is clearly one important thing. But what some people call fiduciary responsibility is another one as well. The notion that you care about me, and more important than you know, people accomplishing their task and getting things done and so forth, is the fact that your overriding important value or attitude is my protection in the system. And I need to be convinced that you have that. Now, I want to indicate that, you know, lots of times I'm going to give you a sample problem that people say in adaptive management, and we've talked a lot about transparency. So imagine a situation where our risk reports on Yucca Mountain are gradually developing in the process, and they're changing and they're growing and becoming higher quality. Now, we've all said you need to get out there early with the public, right? You need to be transparent. You get some initial results in your risk work in. You should be putting them out there, right? But what if they're wrong in the early stages and you put them out? Well, you're being great in terms of being transparent, in terms of engaging the public, free flow of information, and so forth, but you're sure looking competent. So I should trust you on one hand because you're being very, you know, transparent and sharing information and all that. I shouldn't trust you on the other hand because you're incompetent about you doing your how you're doing your risk work. So what does a person do in that situation? I just want to indicate that how there are difficult management problems in trying to deal with the notion of building trust, because there are a lot of things that you do that build trust in one way and distrust in the other way, and it's happening at the same time. Another thing that we found out is Paul Slovic has done this, who's a psychologist in Oregon, has done this interesting work and developed what he called the asymmetry principle of social trust. Well, he did these interesting experiments with students and others in which he found out that, to sum it all up without taking you through all the details, is you can lose trust in a minute, as Paul said, with a single action of things, and then it takes repeated occurrences of doing everything right over a long period of time to recover the trust. Okay, now consider that in light of bio-legacy discussion. Okay, so we've done a pretty good job, as many of you noted in your talks, of losing the public trust. Why do you think you're going to get it back anytime quickly? It's not going to happen. And we have, you know, so sort of theoretical and analytical reasons as well as intuition for believing that. Okay, can we go on? Maybe I should go to, we're really out of time. Why don't I go to my, I want to say something about this and then I'll go to my last slide. I think it's a very interesting question about how climate change and the current rash of escalating energy prices, how that is going to affect the future public response, public attitudes, and so forth, existing public concerns about radioactive waste. I don't think we know that now. We all have some intuition about it. The simple intuition should be that it should change the benefit structure, but it may not change risk perception, public risk perceptions. It may change the benefit perceptions. And that may well affect the acceptability of the program. We know sort of theoretically that if you make the benefits large enough, people accept high levels of risk and they'll accept whatever the technology or the particular choice is. So that would sound good about climate change and rising energy prices. It makes nuclear look a lot better from the on the benefit side. But it may not change the perception of risk side. And so exactly how that will play out then in citing and in decision making, where some of those deeper concerns about risk are still there, but there's more appreciation of benefits, how is that all going to work? We really don't know. This is, you know, the kind of thing that we really should be doing research on to see really important information, and I think that a lot of people now that are looking at the nuclear prospect over the next 20 years are making assumptions about this. This is researchable kind of stuff. I mean, we really need to try to analyze it. Last slide, please. I'm going to skip over this. We'll talk about when some other time. All right, so here would be my sort of last list of thoughts as we move to the next generation of nuclear activity, if we do that, and to any future. I think the consent pathway is the pathway to go down on this, and we're behind most, from my point of view, most other countries in this area. And a question I've been interested in for some time is, why do Sweden, Finland, Canada, even I think in the UK and France are making some progress on this now? How come they can learn from experience better than we seem to be able to do? Why haven't we been able to make some of the kind of institutional changes and shift that process more in the direction of consent? And if we had done that earlier, we'd be much farther along with Yucca Mountain than we currently are. You've heard me argue that I think explicitly this will require us not to explain away the legacy of distrust, but actually try to deal with it, to build it into our processes. This is going to require, as many people have noted, public involvement and transparency at all stages. I think it also means engaging the critics and doubters. I once was involved in the low-level waste program in New York State and was advising people there on their public engagement program, and we had a talk about, I think, the first people you should be dealing with are your critics and so forth. What typically happens in most places is they get isolated off and nobody talks to them and so forth. They should be the people that you talk to most. So I was encouraging them when they got a new report. The first people who got the report were the critics and the doubters, and then there was conversation around that. And anyhow, I think the citing process has to be a dramatically different one, with many of the ingredients that Klaus described that Sweden and Finland are using, or what Tom Isaacs described about Canada. I think that's where the movement is in most societies that are trying to rethink their program. It certainly was the thrust of the rethinking report in the Academy, or I don't know, I don't see John Hearn down there, who also chaired a really good report on the disposition of spent fuel and radioactive waste that carried along a lot of the things that were developed in the rethinking report. And evaluation needs to be a whole part of this process. I mean, evaluation of the public engagement program. We probably won't get the repository right from the start, neither will we get the public engagement program right from the start. So we need to learn from it as we're going along. We need to continue to develop and make corrections in it and so forth as we learn what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong and who we're missing out there and all those kinds of things. Okay, and there's a lot more to be said about all these things, but I've already gone too long, so thank you.